Have it, whether you access it by pushing a button or turning some pages, if you would join me in the second chapter of the book of Esther. Thanks, while you're turning, let me just say thanks for your partnership with us, and on behalf of our network convention, whatever you call it, really it's a collective of 562 churches on mission together. In fact, a week from tonight, we begin our annual celebration in Ocean City, and if you're able to join us, I would invite you out, would encourage you to attend that, multiple sessions for training, for leadership development, as well as raising your awareness on several issues, and most importantly, the business session where you get to learn and speak into the process of how we will conduct our mission together in 2016. So if you can be there at the Fontainebleau Clarion Hotel in Ocean City, we would welcome you to be a part of that. So thank you again for your partnership with us. It's churches like this one that allow us to do the kind of things that we can do together. There's been a term in our national vocabulary for a few decades now. It's a term we use in several different ways, and it's the term that you see reflected in the title up there. It's the phrase, hiding in plain sight. Now, NSA, other government entities use that to describe terrorist cells that hide among us and seek to live among us. They might be right here among us, but we don't see them. Sometimes you may refer to that term to describe an individual who's in a witness protection program. Maybe they've testified against a violent criminal and now they have to assume a new identity and move to another part of the country. That would never work for me, given my voice. I could never tell anybody I was from Canada and have them believe it. But for some people, that's sort of a believable thing, right? You take on a whole new identity and there you are out there in the midst of everybody, but they don't really see you for who you really are. And we use that phrase, hiding in plain sight. In the Rainey household, I use this phrase to describe ketchup. And the reason I do that is because half the time my wife tells me where it is, and I open the pantry door, the refrigerator door, and I can't find it. And I say, it's not here. And she says, yes, it is. And then Somewhere along the way, I end up accusing her of moving it, which really bolsters up the marriage builder kind of thing. And then all of a sudden, she walks over to me, reaches right in front of my face, gentlemen. I know you don't have that issue, but I do sometimes, and just pulls it off. I swear, there's something that happens to a man when he puts one of these on. All of a sudden, he becomes instantaneously blind every time he opens up a cabinet door or a refrigerator. And so for that reason, all the condiments in the Rainey household are seen, by Joel at least, as hiding in plain sight. So I don't know how you use this phrase. There are a number of ways you can do it. But if you've been walking with Jesus for any length of time, you probably have had some circumstances in your life that have hit you that have made you wonder if God couldn't be described that way. Where is He? How do I access Him? How do I even know He's here in the midst of the kinds of things that are going on in my life? Now, sometimes that's just over little frustrations, things that don't alter your universe or really adversely affect you in a long-term way. Unexpected traffic makes you late for a meeting. Bad day on the golf course. Bad day at the fishing lake. Something along those lines. Something I had, in fact, happened to me just in the last year. In fact, it was a little over a year ago today that we were in Florida. We made a decision back in the spring of 2014 to take our children to Walt Disney World. And we looked at the calendar, and we kind of unpacked it, and we said, we want to do this. We want to bless our kids. Two of the three had already been there. And we said, well, let's just go again. This will be great for several reasons. And we saw, according to the Disney calendar online, that October would be a great time to go because it's fall, it's a little cooler down there, and because it's not nearly as crowded. That's all a lie. You should just know. And so we pack this up, and you get down there. They call Disney World the happiest place on earth. Now, if you've never been there, what you need to know, or if you're thinking about going there, that's only true until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. After that, it even in October, it's 1,000 degrees. The lines are horribly long. Your kids turn into midget demons. It's just a horrible kind of thing. And so that's where we were. We found ourselves. Moreover, my six-year-old daughter has fallen in love with this character named Elsa. And that was her big dream. She wanted to see Elsa, meet Elsa, get Elsa's autograph, dress like Elsa. And so we went through that whole shebang, right? We got to get her to see Elsa, right? I told this story once in another church, and I never finished it. And I swear I had like 8 grandmothers walk up to me. You did take her to... Yes, I did. I really did. We did take her to see Elsa, so let me go ahead and finish the story before I walk it back a little bit. But what you need to know is that Disney has a fast pass thing. If you don't know what that is, it's basically a way that you can cut in line on a limited number of rides or attractions, and you don't have to wait quite as long. Well, that system had completely changed, unbeknownst to us. There were none left for Elsa, and the line to see her was 2.5 hours long. Now, just to give you a sense of who I am, because you don't know me, all right? I have virtually every album that Johnny Cash ever produced. But if the Man in Black himself came back from the dead, I would not wait in line for 2.5 hours. I just wouldn't do it. Not going to do it. That's just me, right? And so we gathered, you know, Mrs. Rainey and I gathered in our hotel room that night, already put the kids to bed, and we formulated a plan. We will get there at rope drop. And the minute it drops, we'll go straight to the venue. And maybe we still have to wait a half an hour or so, but we'll go straight to the venue. All right, that's what we'll do. A little fist bump between me and the wife. We go to bed, not thinking about the fact that 25 million other people might have had the same idea. So we get there at rope drop. It's a madhouse. My wife has a stroller and a backpack in the stroller, and so she's got to go through the Disney TSA line. All right? Now, all I have is my 9-year-old son. If they were smart, they'd check his pockets before they check my wife's backpack. But I don't have to go through TSA Disney, right? So here's what I do. I say, we'll go up to the front of the line, and when the rope drops, I'll sprint carrying my 9-year-old, literally throwing him over my shoulder, right? And we will meet, because we don't take our phones with us. It's a rule when we are on vacation. My phone gets turned off. It gets put in the console of the van. The liability, of course, of that is if you lose one another. So we said, here's what we'll meet. The rendezvous point will be the back of the line. I'll see you. All right, I'll see you. Mwah! And then I never saw her again. Right? So we move. We're coming through this line. And if you've ever been to Disney, you know there's this bridge. And as you come through it, I look, and there's 2 other holes. And it literally looks like people are being squeezed out of a toothpaste tube. I'm serious. They said the crowd was going to be low. And apparently every county in the state of Florida was out of school that week. And so we said, oh, this is a madhouse. So I got this kid over my shoulder. I'm aggravated, happiest place on earth. This wonderful lady, Badge, one of the cast members, comes out of the little exhibition hall right next, looks at me, and says, good morning, sir. How are you? I said, I'm fine. Where's Elsa? She's over there. And so I sprinted. But I never was able to connect to my wife. And by the time I got to the attraction, there was a big sign that said, do not queue up until your entire party is present. And by the time I found my wife, and I'm thinking to myself, I should have just brought my daughter. Now, that's just me. I'm stupid like that. So by the time we got together, the wait was back up to 2.5 hours. You ever had a day like that? When you were on vacation, and it was supposed to be, it will be fun, they said. Let's go do this. You ever had a day like, how many of you have ever had a week like that? Just a frustrating kind of thing. But at the end of the day, or at the end of that week, you could shrug it off, because again, nobody lost their life over it. Nobody developed a chronic illness over it. You may even laugh about it, and then for guys in my line of work, we actually get sermon material out of it. So it works for all of us, but you're still kind of frustrated, and you're like, man, what's the deal? Then there are those other moments, those far more serious moments in life. Globally, sometimes it looks a lot like the film you just saw. Even here in the States, that could take the form of a chronic illness that substantively and profoundly changes your life, as well as the lives of those around you who love you, who now have to care for you. It might be a messed up marriage, the loss of livelihood, a death of a child. Any number of circumstances like that can swell completely out of your control. And if you've ever been at those points in your life, the story of Esther is your story. It really is. Now, unfortunately, it's not a story that gets told very often because we really don't know what to do with it. Now, there's certain parts of it that we love. But the part I'm about to read, we have trouble trying to figure out how this fits into our theology, and the way that we live our lives. Read with me beginning in verse 1, and you'll begin to see this unfold. I think it's going to be a long section of text that we're going to read together, but I think it's very important that we digest this together and get a sense of the, the heaviness, the complexity that lies in this part of the narrative. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's young men who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the citadel, under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. And let their cosmetics be given them. And let the young woman who pleases the king, young woman who pleases the king, be queen instead of Vashti." This pleased the king, and he did so. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at, and when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in custody of Haggai, Esther was also taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor. And he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her portion of food, and with seven chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. I'm not sure if that's a compliment or not, ladies, to say that you're among the first in a harem. Esther had not made known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. Now when the turn came for each young woman to go into King Ahasuerus, after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for the women. That's some more spa treatment, isn't it? When the young woman went in to the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem in custody of Shashgash, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go back to the king again unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. In case you didn't notice, this is one jacked up book and one weird, messed up story. And if we have to be honest with ourselves, we have to say that it's not a portion of the story that aligns really at all with how Esther is sometimes characterized, even in our Sunday school literature. If Disney were going to make another princess like and name her Esther, her story would have to look a lot different for it to be G-rated, and it most assuredly would not include the narrative that we just read. This is interesting. Now, there are parts of this book that we like. You fast forward a couple of chapters, and we love that portion where Mordecai challenges her. You must go to the king, for who knows but what you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. We love sort of the end of this story and how God brings and about and uses some of these horrific things to redeem his people who are still in Persia, and to do it with this woman who's known to her family as Hadassah. But when you examine even the sermon records in our own denomination, there's just not a lot of this book that gets expounded upon. Most of it gets ignored. We really don't know what to do with it. For one thing, it lacks the abundant moral clarity that we find in similar literature in the Old Testament that was written in roughly the same period of history. For example, Daniel. Well, you think about Daniel and the way he stood for his faith. You think about the fact that he demands concessions to his Jewishness. He won't eat the king's food. He prays in open rebellion against Babylon. Prior to that, his three colleagues, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, are threatened with a fiery furnace, and they say to Nebuchadnezzar, "We will not bow. Our God is able to forgive us, but is able to save us. But even if he doesn't, we still will not bow." That's black and white. That is right and wrong. There is abundant clarity in that. And then we come to Esther, which is written not too many years, actually, after the events that take place in Babylon with Daniel and his compatriots. And we just don't see, at least on the surface, that same level of devotion. She hides who she is by taking the name Esther. Most biblical scholars will tell you that's a derivative of the Babylonian term Ishtar, the name that the Babylonians gave to the goddess of fertility and love. She doesn't reveal her true identity or that of her family. Verse 9 seems to clearly imply that she eats the king's food. She doesn't refuse. She doesn't seem to stand on principle with the same clarity that we saw in her ancestors. And perhaps the most troubling part, if we're honest, is the way that she wins the king's favor. Now, before we get too deeply into that, let's be fair to Esther. This is, from all that we can tell reading this narrative, a situation that is completely out of her control. In fact, if we were to tell this story in the 21st century, we would actually use the term human trafficking, because that's what's happening here. And Esther is the textbook candidate. She's an orphaned young lady who's attractive, who's been adopted by her uncle, both of whom are in a political and other kind of situation that is completely beyond their control. And in that context, she is summoned to the king's palace. She's put first into the charge of Haggai, who is in charge only of the women who had not yet been with the king. Specifically, they're called virgins here. And then after meeting with the king, she's placed under the care of Shashgash, who is in charge of the concubines. Most of the women, by the way, who moved into that group never saw the king again. And because of what happened to them in the king's chamber, they were basically condemned to a virtual widowhood for the rest of their lives, precisely because they were no longer virgins, but they were concubines. And when you get to verse 15, it's Esther's turn. And this is where we see a strong conflict between what Scripture actually says and so much of what we would like to believe. Because like you, I read this story, and what I'd like to believe is that Esther somehow stood out. Somehow she was different than the others, and that difference really was anchored in the fact that Esther, unlike all of those women, demonstrated modesty, chastity, purity, devotion to God. There's just a couple of problems with that view, though. First off, as we already said, Esther's not Daniel. You don't see that stout moral clarity. You also don't see a woman who's really in charge or even able to do anything at this point except to comply. But the second issue with that perception of her has to do with and surrounds the character of this man Ahasuerus, or as he is otherwise known, Xerxes. I want you to think about the actions of the Persian king here. Everything beginning at the beginning of this story, from the way he abused and banished his former queen to the process by which he selects a new queen. This is a man whose raw abuse of power is evident in the demise of so many women for his own physical pleasure. So I don't know about you, but when I look at Xerxes, I don't see a guy who's attracted to things like modesty and chastity and purity. And that's why portions of the story of Esther, like this one, sometimes get ignored. It's why we get nervous. Because we come to one inescapable conclusion, and that is that her one night with the king involves precisely what we fear it does. And so where is God in that? Where is God in the midst of an ancient human trafficking situation? Where is God in the midst of sexual abuse, abuse of power? Where is he? This is messy. It's a messy story. But for some of us, again, it's our story. In fact, I'm willing to bet there's a few jacked up stories in front of me. Maybe it's not this bad. Maybe it's worse. I don't know. But people, wherever there are people, there are messes. And I know for a fact the guy speaking to you this morning has his own messy story. So if you're in the middle of a mess and you're wondering where God is, if the phrase hiding in plain sight seems to you to make perfect sense when applying it to the Lord at this point in your life, I want you to see three lessons that rise out of this story that hopefully will encourage you. Here's the first one. God controls both process and product. It's not just the end game that he controls. See, we know what happens at the end of the age. And for our part, since we have a closed canon, we know what happens at the end of this story, don't we? And we love it. And we should love it. We love it. The final result is she does become queen. She uses her influence to save her own people. Justice is rightly served on the anti-Semitic Haman. Mordecai is able to wear the signet ring of the king himself and make policy decisions. And the Jews will forever and even to this very day commemorate these events through their annual Purim festival. So when we look at what happens in the end, we like what happens. But we oftentimes ignore the process by which God attains that product because, frankly, we don't know what to do with it, just like we don't know what to do with the messier parts of our own lives. You look at a situation like the persecution that you saw in this film and you think, how on earth could that happen? You look at a situation like ISIS in the Middle East and you think, how on earth is God in the middle of that? God must be absent from that. And yet, we know that martyrdom is often the way in which the Great Commission gets extended. It's just that we have to admit to ourselves in the midst of that, that martyrdom, even though it's essential, even though it is a God-glorifying event, there's a reason your leadership chose not to show the earlier part of that film to you. It's because there's nothing fun or glorious or pleasurable or attractive about martyrdom when it's happening. And yet we know God uses those things. And if he can use those things, he can use these other things that are happening in our lives. And you have to get this. If you understand that God controls not just the end but the means to the end, it makes a different person out of you. You will be the kind of person who doesn't give up on his marriage when things get a little rocky. You won't be the kind of individual who stops praying for his kids when they start rebelling. You won't be the kind of individual who departs from your church family when something happens that you don't particularly like or when there's some conflict that churns your stomach. You'll stay in it because you realize God's using not just the product but the process to get to the product. And when we get that, we will neither be trite nor trivial about things we don't understand. We'll be faithful to him. Here's the second thing that arises out of this story. God works through our success. He works through our surroundings. And he even works through our sin. See, the elements of this story make it clear that Esther and Mordecai are dealing with circumstances that are beyond their control. But if you pull back and kind of look at this story through the wide-angle lens of this particular period in history, you realize these events really didn't have to happen to begin with. They didn't. It had been prophesied for hundreds of years prior to this moment that God would allow his people the opportunity to go back to Israel and rebuild the temple and reinstitute their system of worship and live once again in that place from whence he had exiled them because of their disobedience and their idolatry. Isaiah had prophesied this to the extent that from hundreds of years prior to these events, he calls out Cyrus by name before the dude's even born. So the Jews, they're anticipating this moment of liberation, emancipation, and yet when it comes, they choose, or at least some of them, choose to stay behind. We really don't know all the reasons for that. Maybe they became comfortable. I don't know. But when it comes, for whatever reason, the point is this. Mordecai and Esther would never have been put into this impossible situation in the first place if they and those who came before them in Persia had obeyed God in the first place and gone home when he opened the door for them to go back home. Think through that when you're making decisions. That the decisions you make, the decisions I make that may be dishonorable to the Lord, we might not pay for them, but our children might. Our grandchildren might. We have to do what's honorable before the Lord. And yet, even if they have to pay for them, God works through those things. He works through those things. Now, we like to play the role of the victim. Can we just be honest about that? All of us love to do that. If we're honest, all of us have a little bit of passive-aggressive tendency in us. And the truth is that we are all victims to some extent, but we are also all perpetrators. And yet God even uses our rebellion for His own purposes. He uses our surroundings for His own purpose. Here's the thing. Here's the problem with that. I like it when God makes Himself look good by making me look good. I like that. But when God makes Himself look good by making me look weak, making me look powerless, taking away my capacity to solve the problem, I start struggling a little bit. I don't know about you, but when I get to that point, I start to struggle. So I see this situation, I'm like, if I'm Mordecai, I'm like going insane. Because I don't know what I mean. My uncle died and his wife, I've got their daughter under my charge and she's been trafficked on my watch. What on earth am I supposed to do with that? I'm going crazy if I'm Mordecai, but there's nothing Mordecai can do at this point. And yet God still works through that. You know, today in evangelicalism, we too often presume that we must be the ones in power, we must be the ones with the spotlight, we must be the ones with the microphone, or else God's not going to be able to work. One of the more preeminent examples of that is this young man whose name is Tim Tebow. Now, I'm a huge football fan, so I remember when he got drafted by the Denver Broncos, almost every evangelical Christian in America started wearing orange and blue, except for me. I almost did, because I love the kid. He's a godly young man. He loves Jesus. He's very vocal about his faith. I think that's wonderful. I think that's great. But then he got cut, and then he got cut again. And now he works, I think, as an analyst for ESPN, and he's playing in some kind of second-tier league, which is great, good for him. But for a while there, the radio and the television were silent with regard to Tim Tebow. And people reacted to that in a visceral way. It was like, I can't believe that his voice has been taken away. I can't believe he was so used by God, and now that microphone is gone, now that spotlight is gone. And of course, then came the accusation. Well, Elway just cut him because he's a Christian. Can I be honest with you? Without you getting mad at me, you can disagree. I think Elway cut him because Elway got Peyton Manning. I'm just going to throw that out there. I'm just throwing that out there. Okay? But here's the thing. Who are we to think God's not still using this young man? Who are we to think that God needs a human microphone, a human spotlight, a human television station to use a young man who has demonstrated himself to all of us that he's going to talk about Jesus wherever he is? Let me tell you something. That young man is always going to be used in powerful ways. It just might not look as good as we'd prefer it to look. That's okay. God is working through it. God is working through the circumstances, the surroundings. He even, as we see in this story, works through human sinfulness. Now, here's the final principle that comes out of this story. God is everywhere, even when He appears nowhere. The name of God never occurs. Not just in this part of the story, the whole story. Even the parts we like, it's not there. Not even one single time. There is not so much as a prayer prayed in this book. There are no prophecies or any other form of direct divine revelation that's recorded for us in this book. God doesn't just seem absent from the circumstances we just read about. He seems absent from the whole story. He's not even there. He's not even mentioned. St. John of the Cross, many centuries ago, called this the dark night of the soul. 16th century poem, describing a kind of spiritual depression. And then some of our theological ancestors, the English Puritans, built on his concept to describe that as a period in somebody's Christian walk when God seems absent, almost to the point that it seems like he's deserted you. And you know, I have to think that as she's waiting in the king's chamber that night, Esther must have thought to herself, that's exactly what's happening. He's deserted me. He has left me. And he's left my people. I mean, what else would she think in a moment, in a time like this? And yet it is God who's taking this night that is filled with sin, filled with victimization, filled with the abuse of power, taking these circumstances that are beyond Hadassah's control, and ultimately, because you and I have the rest of the story, we know he uses them to bring the most powerful king of the most powerful nation in the world at that time to his knees, using this unspeakable set of circumstances to bring truth to the proverb that reminds us that the king's heart is in the hands of the Lord, like a course of water. He directs it in whichever way he chooses. This is the great story of our God, that he is everywhere, even when he appears nowhere. And the story of Esther is a testimony to the fact that in moments when God seems to be hiding, those are often the moments when he is doing his most powerful work. It was late February 1947. The mother of Glenn Chambers opened a note from her now dead son. A few days earlier, he'd been on a DC-4 that had crashed into the 14,000-foot high peak of El Toblazo, just outside of Bogota, Colombia. He was on his way to Bogota and then from there on his way to Quito, Ecuador, connecting to begin a ministry with Voice of the Andes. Before he left the United States, he had scratched out, found a piece of scrap paper, some advertising from a newspaper, scratched out a nice little sweet note to his mother, stuffed it in an envelope, put that in the mailbox. And two or three days after that plane crash, that letter with his handwriting on it finally arrives in the mail. And she opens it up, she reads it, she does what any mother's going to do at that moment, and after she gathers her composure, she just happens to flip it around. On the back, there's this big advertisement, and right in the middle of the advertisement are these three letters, W-H-Y. Why? In big, bold letters. That really is the question, isn't it? I am certain that as she approached the king's chamber that night, Esther must have asked that very same question. She doesn't know the future. Unlike us, she doesn't see the rest of the story. We can see the rest of the story and go, oh, why? She should have had more faith than that. I mean, look how the story ends. And then you're going to freak out when your checkbook button doesn't balance tonight, because the end of your story hadn't been written yet. The end of her story hasn't been written yet. Don't judge Esther too harshly. But do learn from her own dark night of the soul that God is ever present. You learn anything from a story like this, a story as messy as this, you learn this. God ultimately is too kind to do anything cruel. He is too wise to make a mistake. He is too deep to explain himself. And so if you're in one of those situations where you're asking, if God, is God in this? And the simple answer is yes. And if you wait long enough, if you believe strongly enough, if you're faithful to him and you do what is right until the very end, eventually you'll see him there, hiding in plain sight. Let's pray together. Lord, I thank you for the people of Severna Park. I thank you for giving me the opportunity to share your word with them today. I thank you that you are ever present, even in times that to us are unspeakable and inexplainable. Father, for people who do what I do, that you have called us into this ministry, help us not to be so presumptuous and trite that we try to explain what you're doing, because so often we simply don't know. But through stories like Esther, we know that you are there. And may we encourage each other as the body of Christ to cling to you during moments like that. I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Would you stand with me as we sing?